This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the RPM subteam for URS providers to develop and review questions for the URS providers held on the 21st of February, 2018. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. Currently at this time on audio only, I have Martin Silva-Vallant. In addition to Martin, is there anyone else on telephone only? Hearing no further names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for a recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to co-chair Phil Corwin. Please begin.
Yeah, hi. This is Phil. I'll be doing some informal chairing of this, but let's work collegially, and I'm not going to check SOIs. I know everybody has SOIs up to date. Do we have anything to display here, staff, in terms of overview of scope of work and the questions for providers?
Hi, Phil. This is Ariel from staff. So we do have prepared all the documents posted on the background document material wiki page for the URS provider. So we have all these documents ready that include URS procedures, rules, MOU with ICANN, and other relevant documents. So in case you need to display anything, we're ready to go.
All right. Well, I just clicked on the wiki link. Let me get that up.
Phil, hi, it's Susan. Would it be helpful if we had the kind of, you know, the URS question document and we did somewhat similar to what we did on our last full plenary call, where we just kind of get to the part two and look at the various sort of high-level topics and just kind of work through and go, like, you know, what if any of these would require a question to the providers?
That sounds all right. I'm at the wiki page now. I'm just trying to see what's here. All right, and what was your suggestion, Susan?
Well, I was just thinking if we went to the working, you know, our kind of working document, the one we've been using in previous calls, discussion draft, I think it's called.
Yeah, that's fine. It has incorporated the co-chair suggested questions, and I think we just need something visual to work off here. So let's wait for staff to put that up so we're all on the same page. Okay. All right. All right. So let's see. What page are the provider questions on?
Well, I think we don't really have any at the moment, but I guess that's what our task is. So I thought if we went to page three, that's where kind of part two starts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we could literally just go through and kind of go, you know, in relation to the complaint, you know, is there anything we need to ask the providers? Can they usefully give us any information? And like, yes, what, or no, right, moving on.
Yeah, well, let me just say, I'll start this off, and then everybody, please jump in. I don't want to monopolize anything here. One of the reasons the co-chairs have proposed questions geared to the actual rules, procedures, and MOU, and I there hasn't been much dissent on that. That the one area where there's been disagreement is on a qualitative evaluation of whether the burden of proof has been followed. But as you'll see, the questions here are the procedures fair and equitable for all stakeholders and participants, which is kind of a very subjective question, you know, what's fair, what's equitable, and the procedure should, you know, really the only way the provider should differ from one another would be in any supplemental procedures they have, but they're all supposed to follow the standard ICANN procedures, which follow the rules. So that's one reason we propose it. Next is what changes need to be made to ensure that procedures adopted are consistent with ICANN policies. Now, again, that one presumes that changes need to be made, that something's wrong, and that, you know, again, the co-chairs proposed, are they following the ICANN procedures? And then I guess we could discuss whether those procedures are in some way need to be rejiggered, but at least, you know, the starting point would be, are they in compliance with that? And the next question, are they exceeding the scope of the authority in any of the procedures? Well, if they're following the ICANN procedures, they're not exceeding the scope of their authority. They're doing the right thing. The only question there would be, are they doing something that they shouldn't be doing in supplemental procedures? So, I don't want to read through all of these, but I think that review illustrates the concerns the chairs had about the charter questions and why we proposed to ask, you know, against a much more objective standard, are they following the rules? Are they following the procedures? Are they complying with the requirements of the MOU? And then we can deal later with the question of the burden of proof. But most of this is just should just be about the starting point should be, are they following the rules and procedures they should be following? And then if anyone thinks that the people who created the rules and the procedures got it wrong and that something needs to be considered for revision, we can get into that, but at least the starting point should be, are they in compliance with the rules set forth by ICANN? So I'll stop there, and Susan, I see your hand up if you want to jump in.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Yes, it's Susan. I think going to that point that you're saying, that kind of, are they following the rules? I'm assuming for the purposes of, you know, for the purposes of the task that we're doing now, what we therefore want to work out is what is it we want to ask of the providers. So I'm guessing we want to, if we can't find them ourselves, we want to ask them, you know, please provide any supplemental rules that you have that supplement the ICANN rules, if any. And we want to ask, you know, the questions that we've been talking about on some of the previous calls in terms of what is your what if any guidance do you have that you either formally or informally give to your panelists, if they have some kind of a contract or appointment letter with a panelist, that would be something that would be useful to see. And
let me just add, Susan, I think we can limit the number of a lot of, you know, the base question of are they following the rules adopted for the URS and the procedures set forth to implement it and the things they agreed to do contractually in the MOU. A great deal of that can be checked very easily by members of this sub-team or by support staff. I think at some point we need to go through, and it wouldn't take long, they're not lengthy documents, the rules and procedures in the MOU. The MOU, for example, is only a 2-page document. But I know there are things in there like your panelists should have experience in IP and you should list their names at the website. You know, that's fairly easy for us to check, and, you know, if they don't have things they should have at the website there, we know right off the bat that they either are or not complying or not complying. So I think by just going through the rules, procedures, and MOU, a lot of it we can check ourselves and then limit our inquiries to the areas where we need a response from them. And also we'll need to review the supplemental rules and decide if they're in any way out of sync with the basic rules. But and if they differ substantially from each other, recognizing that NAF has been adjudicating about 90% of the cases. So let me stop there and let's get some other discussion in terms of our basic approach to this. Don't be shy, people. Yes, Michael, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Hear you fine.
Great. Yeah, I think that it's a good starting point to look at levels of compliance with the ICANN rules, but I would also like to dig a little more deeply into how implementation is done and the specific way that the rules are approached. So, for example, it would be good to know a little bit more background about how examiners are selected and what expertise they have. It would be good to know what level of training they're given, what background they're drawn from, whether it represents a diversity of different stakeholders. And it would also be good to know what level of training is given to the panelists in terms of the standard of proof for URF cases. So I think that having questions like that to sort of flesh out a little background on how the providers are approaching this process would be helpful.
Okay, so is staff capturing that? Yeah. So good. Yeah, I think that's a constructive suggestion, that once we do the basic check, we make some inquiry about things like that. What others think?
Martin here.
Hi, Martin. Go ahead.
Just to jump in with more ideas, we can leave this for later or whatever, but we could also use more specific questions towards the application of the rules. Just for instance, there's an interesting section, the section 11, about abusive complaints in the ERS, which is very different from the one that I'm more used to in the UDRP rules. And I would think it would be very interesting to see this strange section for me, which is about abusive complaints, if the providers have their use it, have they used part of it, does it have any application that we can track to see, you know, is it being used or was it useful or whatever?
Yeah, well, the abuse section is finding of abuse by a complainant, as I recollect.
Martin, hi, it's Susan. Would you mind saying that again? I wasn't quite following you, I'm afraid. I didn't quite understand what it was you were suggesting. Sorry.
Sure, yes. The section 11 about abusive complaints, it states that the U.S. shall incorporate penalties for abuse of the process by trademark holders. A complaint may be deemed abusive if the examiner determines it was presented solely for improper purpose, such as to harass, cause necessary, give rules in order to implement the penalties. And one of my questions is, just to start out one idea, we can leave this for later if you have anything better to talk about, is specific points inside the rules we would like to ask. I think it would be interesting to know if providers have even applied in any case these sections, these penalties that the URF could or shall incorporate as it says on the section. Is it clear?
Yeah, that's clear. Sure. I mean, I suppose in terms of there needing to be those penalties, that's presumably something that is captured in the rules in terms of what the penalties should be, either in the overarching rules or in provider supplemental rules. But you're suggesting that we look at have those penalties been applied to anyone? I think.
The question could be even broader. I mean, my question would be, has any provider use part of this section at all? Have you even have a penalties set forward as part of the process? Have you applied them? If we can make it more specific, but I had in mind an idea of a broader thing of how has providers used this section, if at all?
Sure. I think it's reasonable in terms of, what if anything have they got in their rules about what those penalties might be or in their guidance. I'm not so sure about how much of an inference we can draw from whether there have or haven't been any cases on this. I mean, we only have in total a very small number of URS cases, as people are so frequently telling us on this working group. And most of those cases, I think, because of the nature of the type of case that you have to bring if you want to have a successful URS, you know, most of those cases have been won by the complainant. So there's not a very big pool of cases where there even could possibly have been penalties applied.
Yeah, I understand. I agree with your intuition. I mean, I also have the same intuition because, as you said, the numbers are not that hard to follow from distance. I think it's just like I would like to hear the program say we have thought about this, we haven't, we never implemented it, we don't even have any idea what do we do in the terms of penalties. I mean, I would like to hear what the providers have to say about their experience towards this section. Have they ever looked into it? I don't know. And again, this is just an idea. If it's not flying around, it's not flying around.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think. I mean, I guess you know we could the first stage. I guess would be we would look at the abusive. We would look at the rules. You know what supplemental rules they've implemented and the guidance and so on that we were already thinking of asking them. And then I guess if we can't see it, you know, a clear. Evidence that they've been considering the issue, you know, there's a complete silence on the topic, then I guess we might have to go further than that, and that seems reasonable. Justine is suggesting in the chat that we should check the abuse case database, which also seems like a really good suggestion.
Yeah, Phil here. I think it's worth, you know, the small subset of cases where abuse might have been found would be those where they were dismissed because they didn't state a black and white case and the panelists decided they should more properly be filed as a UDRP or as a court case. So we'd want to look at for those cases whether abuse was found in any of them by one of the providers. But it's not an unimportant question, but it's not, I don't think, the starting point. Now, I want to go back briefly to the other three questions here and then make a suggestion for how to proceed on this call that I think might be more productive if other working group members and sub-team members agree. When you look at the other questions, and again, this is why the co-chairs were dissatisfied, what remedies exist or should exist to allow questions about new policies by providers offering URS services, and how can they be expeditiously and fairly created? Well, let me just say, the providers should be following, when it talks about policies, the policies are in the URS rules and procedures. The only place where they should be, have any deviation from one another should be in supplemental rules. So, unless we find that providers have created, principal rules that differ substantially from ICANN rules and procedures, there's no need for this. I mean, and any variation, any change in those overarching rules and procedures should only come out of this working group. They have no authority to create their own rules and procedures, no more than a UDRP provider can create a new version of the UDRP. And finally, the last two questions is ICANN reaching out properly and sufficiently to the community when such procedures are being evaluated at the provider's request. One, I don't know of any case where the provider has requested an evaluation. Two, the procedure that's reviewing it is the one we're engaged in, and clearly it's open and transparent. And finally, are the providers consulting with all stakeholders in the evaluation, adoption, and review. Well, we're the ones doing the review, and we're going to be the ones initiating the consultation with the providers, not them with us. So you can see here these questions, I think, while well-intentioned, really have built-in biases. They're subjective. They are not really focused on key questions. So what I would suggest is that staff could, you know, we've got the link in the chat room to the wiki page, which has all the documents and materials on the URS. If we could, the rules is the starting document. That's in the applicant guidebook. And if staff could put up, I don't know if they have it ready, if they could put up a copy of those rules, or if people want to just go to that link and then click on the rules link, I think we could very quickly go through the rules, see which ones are applied to the providers, and very quickly say, well, here's, you know, in each case, this is where we should be reviewing and making sure that they're in compliance. So here we are. This is the rules. I don't think we really have to go through the definitions right now. Then there's communications. I don't think there's any questions for the providers in the communications section, other than are they accepting communications set forth in the manner required by the rules. So let me stop there. Does anyone, and you can scroll through this quickly yourself, other than determining whether providers are accepting communications which meet the standards in the guidebook, can anyone else think of any other question we'd want to ask about the provider in regard to the communications provision section of the applicant guidebook on the URS? All right, I don't hear anyone. I don't see any. Yeah, go ahead, Susan.
Hi, sorry. Yeah, I was trying to work out if this is the right section or not, but I'll just say it, and if I'm in the wrong place, then so be it. We did talk about, on the last call, we talked about this concern in relation to notice and you know, whether registrants are receiving notices or not. I'm kind of making an assumption that falls within this communication section. And obviously I don't know if they have it, but it seems to me that we could usefully ask the providers whether they have any records of undeliverable notices, or whether they have kept any records of registrants coming to them and saying they didn't get the original complaint.
Okay. Yeah, when we go through this in this is section 2, communications. A sets forth it says it shall be the provider's responsibility to employ reasonably available means calculated to achieve actual notice to respondents. So I think responding to you, Susan, we could ask them, how do you provide the notice to the respondent? And then we can decide whether that's a reasonable means that's likely to achieve its purpose. And are they sending all the documents, the notice of complaint, to the right addresses? So then everything's by electronic communication. There's no physical hearing or physical documents in this procedure, much like the UDRP. Section C says any communication to the provider or the examiner shall be made by means in the manner stated in the supplemental rules. So we'd want to look at the supplemental rules. That's something we'd want to check to make sure that we think that's reasonable. I haven't looked at them. I'd be surprised if they're not a reasonable way to communicate. Section E is about updating contact details. I guess you'd have to get the initial notice if you're the respondent to do that. So F is just about communications made via the internet, by fax, or by post or courier service. I guess we could ask what percentage of communications received by providers has been by a means other than via the internet. I'd be surprised if it was more than a very tiny percentage, if at all. Then the next one's about time periods. So I guess we could ask the providers, how do you, are you running your clock in conformance with that? So, you see, as we go through this, we can come up with very simple, objective questions that are all geared to finding out whether providers are following the rules. And we're not, if in the course of that we decide that the rules need to be rejiggered, that they don't do what they're intended to do, that's a different question. But the starting point should be compliance with the rules. Section I is about the responsibility of the sender to retain their own records. That's not a responsibility of the provider. So there's no question there. And I guess J raises a question for me. In the event the party sending a communication receives notification of non-delivery, the party shall promptly notify the provider. I'm assuming that communication would be to the provider. So if they don't get through the first time, how would they get through to let the provider know that there was a bounce back? But we can look into that one. So I'm going to stop there. That's about communications between the two parties and the provider. Does anyone else see any questions that spring to mind that we might consider to providers based on that section of the rules? And if not, I'm just going to proceed because we're 30 minutes into this and we're on page 4 of a 16-page document. As you see, I'm just trying to go through quickly. I'm not trying to monopolize the conversation. Okay, so complaint. This is mostly about the element of the complaint. So I'm scrolling through it quickly. I don't know what we'd ask the provider about this other than do they accept complaints which don't contain all the elements required, or are they adding additional requirements through supplemental rules beyond what's required in these rules? But there is something here on abuse and subsection E, the complaint will not be accepted. The provider's check of the repository, see Rule 17, finds the complainant has exceeded the quota of abusive complaints. Well, that could be part of a general inquiry about provider enforcement and review of the abuse provisions of the URS. That relates to complainant abuse. G, I guess I'd ask the providers, how do they check to see if the domain name that the case is brought against is one that's already the subject of an active URS or UDRP case? I'd be surprised if that happens very often, if at all, but it's still, because this is a requirement, how do they check that? How do you find out if a domain name is subject to another URS complaint simultaneously at another URS provider, or is the subject of a UDRP at one of the several UDRP providers? It seems like they'd almost have to go to each one, and I don't even know how you check that, because I know that WIPO cases and NAF cases, you only sometimes you don't know a case has been filed until they've published the decision. I'm going to stop there. Justin has his hand up, and I think I heard Susan speaking up as well. So let's start with Justin, and then if Susan did want to speak, we'd go to her after that. Justin?
Yes, hi. I just wanted to ask about Kathy, something that Kathy brought up regarding SMD files. There was an incident that was reported that one of the providers wasn't, well, you know, in terms of the examiner, wasn't looking at SMD file. So I wasn't sure what extension SMD files carry, but I wanted to raise the fact that the European provider actually lists down the types of files that can be uploaded to the system, and they specifically listed SMB files as one of the types of files. But the forum doesn't do that. So I was just wondering whether there's an inconsistency there. Thanks.
Right. Well, that relates to part small v of this section we've been reviewing, which requires that the trademark or service marks on which the complaint is based and the goods or services with which the mark is used be submitted directly or by including a relevant SMD from the trademark clearinghouse. So reading that, it looks like the complainant can either directly say this is the mark and this is the goods and services that it covers, or they could the or indicates they could, instead of doing that, they could include the relevant SMD from the clearinghouse. You know, there's no requirement that a trademark be registered in the clearinghouse to bring a URS against a domain that's allegedly infringing as the trademark. Providing the SMD is just a simpler way to provide that data if you've been registered in the clearinghouse. So it's an either-or depending on whether the mark, and even with a mark that's in the clearinghouse, if you read this literally, there's no requirement to submit the SMD. You could still do it simply by including the information in the complaint. So in regard to what you brought up, Justin, that's the provision of this section, that's a subsection that seems to relate to it. Susan, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. I was just going to comment on that paragraph G that you were talking about in terms of the, you know, not there shouldn't be a complaint if the domain name is already part of an open or active case. I wonder whether we need to be worrying too much about this. I'm not sure that this is really a responsibility for the provider, is it? It seems to me that obviously if it was a complaint that was being defended, that if you as the registrant were already defending a URS or a UDRP case, the first thing you would do would be go, hang on a minute, there's already a live case on this, so why are you bringing another one? Now, I suppose there could be a situation where it's not defended, but it seems to me that if you reach a point where one set of proceedings as you know, issues a decision that might be to suspend the domain name, well then kind of there isn't that much scope for duplicative proceedings, because at that point the domain name's been suspended and it's pretty obvious that there's been a URS.
Susan, let me suggest this. I think I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I think the question to providers might be in regard to this subsection 3G, do you do it? You know, really, it doesn't say, it's really whose responsibility is it? Is it the complainant's responsibility to check this before filing the complaint? Is it the provider's? Or is it neither's, and are they just relying on the respondent to come back and say, hey, wait a minute, I'm already in a, somebody else already filed a URS with a different provider or a UDRP against this domain? I would think the chance of this occurring, I think, is very small. So I don't think it's something we should get hung up on. I agree with you there, but I think we would want to ask the providers, do you do any check, or do you just rely on the complainant or the respondent to make sure there's not an open case against this domain? Some more informational if you get my drift.
Sure. Can I reply?
Sure.
I guess I'm okay with asking an informational question as long as we don't draw an inference. If they say no, that there's not an automatic inference being drawn that they perhaps should be doing this check, because, you know, this is a kind of quick and dirty procedure that was supposed to be cheap and cheerful. I mean, it's supposed to, you know, it's obviously supposed to get the right outcome, but, you know, there is some stuff that probably isn't the responsibility of the provider. And ultimately, if the complainant brings multiple cases against the same domain name, then at some point they risk being found to be abusive, or, you know, they risk having their previous decision being overturned because it was brought in breach of the rules. It doesn't strike me that that's terribly different to if you go to court. You shouldn't have a court action that is basically the same proceedings being brought, you know, twice in court. But, you know, no one expects the clerk of the court to go searching around in other jurisdictions to make sure that the same case isn't being brought in a court in another town or something. Do you know what I mean? There's a kind of presumption that the parties will follow the rules, and if they don't, that they run the risk of having whatever successful outcome they had overturned. With the added benefit that, of course, any respondent would raise this issue as being, you know, an abuse. So I don't mind asking an informational question, but I think we need to be careful not to be setting ourselves up for some kind of a presumption then that something needs to change if the answer is no.
Yeah, and Susan, I agree with you. I don't think there should be any presumption that we find that providers aren't the ones checking it. It's really ambiguous from the way this subsection G is written, whether it's the complainant's responsibility or someone else's responsibility. Again, it could be the complainant's responsibility to check, you know, say, hey, I want to, let me back up and say the odds of two different trademark owners bringing simultaneous URS or UDRP cases against the same domain and having marks which are in some way different, or maybe the same mark for different goods and services against the same domain, I guess it's possible, but it's extremely unlikely. And I'm more interested in just finding out how the providers view this section, and I wouldn't be of the view that there's necessarily some shortcoming on their part if they're not checking this. But I'll stop there. I see Cynthia has her hand up, so why don't you go ahead, Cynthia, and then I think we can close this one out. It's probably not the most important thing we need to be asking about.
Hi, this is Cynthia, and yes, I just – probably is not the most important thing that we could be talking about. But I did have one observation, because it's actually come up for me in my work a couple of times where there could potentially be a legal action like a receivership or some kind of a case like that, and the respondent does not respond either because they no longer have control of their own domains or because they're under some kind of a receivership decree. I have seen several cases where trademark holders have tried to, put out URS procedures when the receivership had control of the domains and the respondent couldn't respond. So I do wonder who is looking, because the complainant may not necessarily know that the domain is part of a receivership or some other kind of entity like that. I mean, how would they even find that out? Who would know? And I don't know. It just seems like it's the kind of thing that would fall through the cracks.
Yeah, I agree. And again, I just want to – I'd be interested to know how the providers, if they do anything in regard, how they view – what is their view of if they have any responsibility under this provision or assume it's someone else's responsibility. We might want to come back at some point and – recommend a change in this language, because it's really very unclear here who's, it just states a general rule that there shouldn't be a URS filed against a domain that's already the subject of another dispute resolution process, but it's completely unclear as to how that's supposed to operate. So we could consider whether we should just take this out or say, you know, the first case is the one that the first one filed is the one that prevails. I mean, just thinking off the top of my head, you could have a UDRP filed today and a URS filed next week against the same domain, and if they don't know, if you have, they're both default cases, and nobody knows that the other action exists, the later filed URS could be decided prior to the prior filed UDRP. So which decision prevails? I don't know the answer to that, but...
Well, I would say, honestly, Phil, I would say the answer to that is in the rules and isn't unclear at all. It says the URS may not be filed against something which is already part of an open and active case. So, you know, if the URS is filed later and UDRP was the first filed, then that's the one that should stand. And the URS decision may get maybe issued first, but that was an invalid URS proceedings. I don't think this is, as you said, I mean, I don't think this is something we need to get hung up on.
Okay. Let me stop here and ask an overarching question. We're doing pretty well. We're on page 6 here. I'm trying to go through this as quickly as possible. I would just like, from this sub-team members, do people feel that this approach of going through the rules, and then we'll do the same for the procedures, and then the MOU, which is only 2 pages, that this is a productive path, and that this is going to yield targeted, objective questions, some of which we can answer ourselves, just go into the URS provider's webpage, some of which we're going to need to ask them about. But at the end of this process, we would have a set of, so many questions which are based directly upon the rules and procedures and which give us will give us very objective yes or no answers in regard to whether the providers are doing the right thing by following the rules and procedures. So if you agree that this is a productive approach, I'd ask you to click the green agree. And if you have a problem with this approach, click the X disagree. But I want to, at this point, since we've been doing this for about 30 minutes, get feedback from the group on whether this is a good path. All right. Well, I'm seeing all green checks so far, and no disagrees. So I'll take that as support for going forward in this manner. And again, this is what the co-chairs had in mind when we suggested what we did in terms of checking the actual provider performance against the very objective standards here. Okay. Subsection 4, notice of complaint and locking of domain. The provider shall include a copy of the complaint in this notice to registry operator. So are they doing that? I would think they are, because the registry operator is not going to do anything. They're not going to lock the domain unless they get that. Are they transmitting, Part B, are they transmitting the notice in English? Are they translating into the predominant language using the registrant's country or territory as listed, or who is record? So I guess the question there would be, are they checking the who is record to determine what language the transmission of the complaint to the respondent should be made in? And Part C is the electronic copy of the complaint may be provided via email or emailed link. So are they doing that? It's pretty simple, objective questions. I'd be surprised if any of them aren't following that, because I can't imagine what they'd be doing otherwise. But it's just, due diligence to ask those basic questions. I'd be surprised if any of them came back and said they're doing something different. Though I think the one on language is one we want to particularly look into, to be fair to non-English-speaking registrants who are using or filing who is records in languages other than English. Anybody want to comment on that subsection 4 before we move on to 5? And let me say, I'm assuming that staff, in writing up at the end of this, I know they're taking notes, will, coming out of this session, will produce a list of proposed questions according to adhering to what we've reviewed here.
Okay. Hi, this is Lori. I just joined by audio. I'm sorry. I thought the time was 1400, not 1300. I'm sorry.
That's okay, Lori. Let me tell you what we've been doing. We went through the charter questions, and there was general agreement that they had built-in biases, they weren't objective, and they weren't a very productive way to go. We've gone now, our starting point has been the actual URS rules as contained in the applicant guidebook. We're reviewing them, and out of each subsection, we're pulling out proposed objective questions to providers, well, regarding providers' adherence to the rules, some of which we can check ourselves, either working group sub-team members or staff, some of which will need to be checked with providers, but it's providing a very objective route to reviewing providers' adherence to the rules that we currently have. It doesn't preclude anyone from proposing changes in those rules and procedures, but the starting point is, are they adhering to what was adopted in the guidebook? And if, just before you got on, after doing that about 30 minutes, we asked everyone if they were finding this a productive means, and there it was all green checks and no red arrows. So
Okay. Quickly,
that's what we're doing, and that's where we're at. And
okay. I have been having a problem getting into the Adobe, so I'll listen, and then I'll contribute to any Google document after the fact. So I'm on audio only at the moment. My Adobe wasn't connecting in my mobile.
Okay, Lori. Well, I'm going through each everything relevant here, so you won't miss much without the Adobe. And yet, there is a all the documents we're doing are at the wiki. They're easy to find.
Thank you, Phil. I really appreciate it and apologize for my tardiness.
No problem. All right, moving on. We're on Section 5 of the rules. This is a section regarding the response from the respondent. And going through subsection A, it says what the response shall include, name, postal, and email address. I'm not going to read all of these. Respond specifically to each of the grounds on which the complaint is based and include any defense. Respondent may request a finding the complaint was brought in abuse of the proceedings. That, again, Martin, relates to your concern about how providers are dealing with the abuse aspect of the URS. So I guess we'd want to ask the providers, have they gotten any responses alleging abuse, and how have they reviewed, how have they acted in those cases? The next part is that the respondent should identify any other legal proceedings that have been commenced or terminated. That would relate to what we just discussed about the bar to bring a URS against a case that's already in another URS or UDRP. I think also thinking like a lawyer, this refers to legal proceedings. I'm always concerned when one part of a statute, or in this case rules, uses one terminology and the next one uses different terminology. I'd want to know, as we consider this, and this is a question for the working team, whether the term legal proceedings encompasses URS and UDRP. I would think it would, but it's not. Others might disagree. And since this is what the respondent is being asked to include in their response, then should subsection G be modified in some way to refer to open and active legal proceedings, including UDRP or URS cases, just to make everything consistent? Because we've got one section here that refers to URS, UDRP, and then we're asking the respondent to list legal proceedings without any perfect clarity as to whether that encompasses URS and UDRP. Again, personally, I believe it does, but someone else might argue to the contrary. Cynthia, go ahead.
Hi, this is Cynthia. And this goes back to an earlier point that I made in the chat, which is that we should probably see the document, the forms that are being filled out from each provider, because given the, if this wedge right here goes out to each one of the providers and they each create their own forms, it could be that there are many different pieces of language being used to the same thing, and that depending upon which form they're filing in, you know, a respondent could have a variety of different ways of answering to something. So I think we kind of need to see the forms from each provider to make sure that there's some standardization of the language and terms and, you know, the questions that are being asked.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, but my response would be, and then I'm going to call on Susan, is that we should review that. We should note that for when we review the supplemental rules. That's, I think, where we would find those forms. If not, we can ask for them directly. But I think the best way to proceed here is the way we're doing, starting with the rules that are in the guidebook, then with the procedures that were promulgated by ICANN to implement the rules, and we want to make sure the procedures are consistent with the rules. Then we're going to look at the MOU, which is a two-page document, and while there's three different MOUs, they should be all exactly the same. I can't imagine that ICANN entered into three different, you know, materially different contracts to implement the same RPM. And then we can, at the end of the exercise, we can look at the supplemental rules where there's going to be the most variation between providers. And, of course, a threshold question is, and this gets to what some of the charter questions we're trying to reach, but in a very muddled way, is have the providers adopted any supplemental rules which go beyond being administrative in nature and which actually in some way change the fundamentals of the RPM. And I'll stop with that statement, and unless Cynthia had a response to that, I'll let Susan talk. Did you have any response, Cynthia?
Yes. Just a quick response that the reason I talked about the form that's being filled out by the complainant and whatnot is because it's mentioned earlier in this document that we're reading that the providers will come up with a form to be completed by the parties.
Okay. Well, you know what? We can consider. I wouldn't object if after we complete review of the full rules, and we're halfway through that at this point, about halfway through, we could look at that form. If that, I wouldn't want to look at all the supplemental rules out of order, but I think looking at that form, I wouldn't object to it. We can consider that at the end of this review of the rules. Susan, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Just really quickly, I think I'm agreeing with both of you, really. I think Cynthia's point about the rules, is, the forms is a really good one. Obviously, we don't want to break off what we're doing to look at that. I don't think that's what she was suggesting, but certainly we will want to do that to make sure that the forms reflect what the procedure is meant to be. But I do agree with you about the terminology, and maybe we should, I mean, unless others disagree strongly, maybe we should capture now as something that we think we'll make a recommendation on, that just so we don't forget it, that you know, we need some kind of standardization between the language that's used in G and the language that's used in this subparagraph here, just to make sure that, you know, that everyone's clear that they're supposed to also be identifying URSs and EDRPs.
Yeah, thank you, Susan. Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. And going back here to the document, this subsection small v, that's just the text of the statement that's supposed to be followed by the signature of the respondent. So all we need to do there is check that that statement is included in the form. And then the next one is annex any documentary other evidence upon which the respondent relies. Well, that's a requirement for the respondent, not for the provider. The provider's only duty there is to accept that as part of the response. Okay, now E gets into something for the provider that would raise a question, at the request of the respondent, the provider may, this is a discretionary authority, in exceptional cases, extend the period of time for the filing of the response. It may also be extended by written stipulation between the parties, that would be between the complainant and the respondent, provided the stipulation is approved by the provider. So that raises, again, the provider there has discretion even where the two parties have agreed to extend things by a week. The provider could say, no, I'm going to decide now. I'm not giving you a week, even an extra week or however much time, even though you reviewed it, and then request for an extension of time shall comply with the provider's supplemental rules. So this all relates to supplemental rules. So this certainly suggests a question one, to look at the supplemental rules when we get to them to see how the different providers handle this discretionary authority they have to grant or deny extensions. And second, I think we'd want to ask the providers, how often have either the respondent asked for an extension, or how often have they gotten a complainant and respondent agreeing mutually to an extension, and how have they acted in those circumstances? I'd be surprised if that's happened very often or if at all, but it's a very simple question to ask the providers, and they will know, I think, right off the bat whether they've ever been asked for an extension and what they've done in that case. And I want to say here, the exercise we're involved in right now, I've looked at the rules before, I looked at the procedures before, but I think it's really going to be beneficial to this working group as we go forward in formulating final questions to have actually gone through this detailed review of what's in the rules and what's in the procedures, so we really have fresh in our mind what the different elements are, because I think without that we'd be creating questions without a firm objective basis for creating them. So I think that's one more good reason we're doing this. Subsection F, no affirmative claims for relief by the respondent will be permitted except for the allegation that the complainant has filed an abusive complaint. I'm not sure that's even creates, suggests a question other than has a provider ever received a complaint for relief beyond an allegation that the complaint is abusive. I'm not sure if that's important, but it's one we might consider. Next one, provider's compliance check for response shall at least consist of ascertaining the response has been filed in a language acceptable under the rules and checking for the payment of the fees. I think if there's a question here, it's whether, since it says at least consist of, ask the providers whether they do anything beyond checking those two things. It's more informational. They wouldn't be doing anything wrong if they check for something else, but I think it might be informative to ask them. And again, it's not a difficult question to answer. They'll either say no, that's the only two things we ask for, or yes, we also ask for this or that. Okay, part H just says the response has to be accompanied by payment of the response fee or reexamination fee as appropriate in relevant cases. I believe that's cases filed against multiple domains, not a single domain. I don't know, does anybody think there's a question there, or the provider would want to collect that fee if it's appropriate. Okay, next one. I don't see anybody raising a hand saying that that suggests a question. So I'll go on to I here. If the response is determined to be non-compliant for reasons other than non-payment, the examiner is permitted to make any reasonable inferences from the inadequacy of the response. So that part of the rules really relates to the examiner. It's questions for the practitioners and examiner. What do people think? Is this a question we should be looking at about what in default cases, I guess we could ask the providers whether they know of any, if they can identify any cases in which they've determined that the response is noncompliant other than the fact that it wasn't accompanied by the payment of the fee. And the payment of the fee, as I recall, is only in cases involving multiple domain names. I forget what the threshold number is, and that would give us a subset of cases to look at and to see if we could simply look at the decisions and see if they say anything about whether the examiner drew an inference from the fact that the response didn't meet the basic criteria set forth. Susan.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. I think that sounds right. These cases are, you know, go to the, even if there was no response whatsoever, the cases still go to the examiner. And so in a case where the response was determined to be non-compliant, it would still go to the examiner. So I think that's fair enough. I think what we could certainly ask a question about how many cases were, you know, did you have that were determined, you know, that received a response, but it was determined to be a non-compliant response. Although, ultimately, I don't know that it makes that much difference. And as I say, because, you know, they all go to the examiner anyway, even cases where there's no response whatsoever still have an assessment. They don't, there's not a kind of judgment in default.
Yeah. Hey, thank you, Susan. I see a question from Justin in the chat. How many responses are filed but fee not paid? I guess we'll find out when we ask, but my recollection is that the respondent doesn't have to pay a fee in most cases. Am I right? If I'm wrong on that, raise your hand or speak up, but this would only...
I guess it's got to involve 15 names or more for there to be a fee, I think.
Yeah, it's 15 names or more. I knew there was a threshold. So in the vast majority of URS cases, there'd never be a rejection of the response for lack of payment of a fee. It would only be in extraordinary cases involving 15 or more domains. The last subpart of section 5 here is subsection K. The provider should normally not accept a late response submitted after the domain name registration has expired, even if submitted before the closing date of the late response window. The provider may, in its supplemental rules, define justified exceptions from this rule. Does someone understand what this section, what factual scenario this subsection relates to? I'm having a little trouble figuring it out. Anybody want to take a stab at it?
Susan, I think it's suggesting that if the timing of the URS is such that sort of by the time the extended period available for responding comes around, the actual, you know, the name is already there would be no acceptance of the response. But I mean, that seems to me to be reasonable, given that if the name has expired, you know, the respondent doesn't own it anymore.
Yeah, I think you're right, Susan. It would be a very odd fact scenario. I would suggest that for this one, we just not try to form a question now, since it states in the final sentence the provider may in its supplemental rules define justified exceptions from this rule, so it's not a hard and fast rule, that when we go through the supplemental rules for the three providers, we should see if they have anything relating to acceptance of a response under these very unusual circumstances. But I don't think, since it's such an odd fact situation, it would be, there's been a URS, there was no, it was a default case. Then after the initial decision, a response comes in, but before it came in, the registration period of the domain expired, which means the domain would have dropped back and could have been re-registered by some other party or not. It's a very odd fact situation. So let's just, I think, keep it on ice right now and look at the supplemental rules. Time check, we're at 2:10. We've got 20 minutes left. We're on page 9 of a 16-page document, so we might get about three-quarters through on this initial call, but I think we're getting a good list of suggested objective questions. Section 6, the examiner. A, each provider shall maintain and publish a publicly available list of examiners and their qualifications. This is one we don't even have to ask the providers. We or staff can check. Very simple. Are the providers maintaining and making publicly available a list of their URS examiners and their qualifications? That's an easy one to check. It's supposed to be publicly available. So let's, you know, maybe staff can check that out before our next meeting. But it should be at their websites. I don't know where else it would be. And then the only other subsection of this section is an examiner shall be impartial and independent, shall have disclosed to the provider any circumstances giving rise to justifiable doubt as to their impartiality or independence. If at any stage during the URS proceeding new circumstances arise that could give rise to it's interesting language, to justifiable doubt. That's an interesting standard, justifiable doubt. To the impartiality or independence of the examiner shall promptly disclose such circumstances to the provider, and the provider shall have the discretion to appoint a substitute examiner. So, I guess possible questions here would be, are the providers making their examiners aware of the need for them to be impartial and independent? And if there's any justifiable doubt, are they telling them they need to disclose it? And both before or if something happens during the case, during the short tenure of the case, that they have a responsibility to promptly disclose. And I guess the other question would be, if there's ever been a case where examiner has said, hey, I really can't be even-handed in this case, what has the provider done? Have they appointed a substitute? Those are the only potential questions I see coming out of that. Michael has his hand up. Michael.
Yeah, I think this relates a little bit back to some of the issues I mentioned at the outset in terms of the training of the examiners and how they're selected and their background expertise. So hopefully that's being included here as well. But I also think, and this I guess ties into something that Justine is also mentioning in the chat, which is it would be useful to dig a little more into that the phrase of impartial and independent, get a little more information about how that's interpreted, what's considered a conflict, what sort of, I guess how the providers look into that and whether it's entirely dependent on self-reporting or whether there's sort of an initial disclosure of any potential conflicts of interest or broadly the interpretation of what kind of standard is applied and how the existence or non-existence of a conflict is ascertained. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. I think, you know, it's clearly a subjective standard, but I'd be interested personally in have there been any circumstances where provider has an examiner who hasn't disclosed some fact that would give rise to justifiable doubt as to their impartiality or independence, and the provider has later found out the lack of disclosure, what have they done about it? Have they permitted that person to continue as an examiner or not? These are clearly subjective standards, impartiality is somewhat subjective. Independence, what does that mean? And what's justifiable doubt? It's really, the burden here is on the examiner to disclose this to the provider. Susan, go ahead.
Thanks, Phil. Yeah, I do think to some extent this is a responsibility of the examiner. My guess is that these, if any of these situations have arisen where there's a challenge to the independence of the examiner, then it's probably a situation where the respondent has done so. You know, they've said sort of, hey, you know, examiner, you act for that complainant, so you are not an appropriate examiner to be hearing this case. If there have been any such cases as that, it would be interesting. I think it would be something we would at least want to look into with the providers of what their process is. If that situation arises, who would make the determination, for example, of whether the examiner has the conflict or doesn't have a conflict in question? One presumes it isn't the examiner themselves. But I think that is something that we could easily look into. Otherwise, I think the other thing that I put my hand up to say was just, I guess I don't know what the rules are in terms of the professional conduct rules in other countries, but it seems to me certainly that in the UK, that one's rules of professional conduct are such that it's an extremely serious matter to be acting in this kind of quasi-judicial role if you have a conflict of interest in relation to one of the parties. I can't believe that's not the case in other jurisdictions.
Yeah, I agree, Susan. Let me say two things here, and then maybe we can move on to the next section. One, as a general rule, my view is that the fact that a examiner in their day practice predominantly represents trademark owners or predominantly represents parties that may be more likely to be respondents shouldn't give rise to any presumption that they can't be even-handed and fair in administering a UDRP or URS. I think the experience I've seen is that most of them go out of their way. That would be different than finding out that an examiner had done work and had an expectation of doing, was presently or had some expectation of doing future work for a complainant. That would be something they clearly should disclose and say, hey, this is a current client or a former client, and I'd like to get business from them again in the future, and I really, that might influence me in this decision. Even if it's a black and white case, maybe it'd be better for appearance sake to let somebody else handle this one. But so I would say on this provision of the impartiality, independence, and justifiable doubt about those, and the examiners, the main responsibilities on the examiner, we should think about an appropriate question about whether that's ever occurred or what has the provider done if they found out that there was non-disclosure, there should have been. And also in reviewing, I didn't see anything in what the respondent has to file. They are allowed to say it's an abusive case. I think as we go forward, we should look as if the respondent has the ability to raise an allegation of bias against the examiner somewhere in their response. I'm not sure if they do or don't, but if we could just note that as we continue to review all of this, that's something I'd be personally interested. Cynthia, go ahead.
Hi, this is Cynthia. You know, I agree with what you've said. I think that most of these folks are experienced professionals. They would identify conflicts. But it's really not about, honestly, whether or not these people are professional and do express the conflicts. It's about the appearance of whether they're impartial. And if we could set up a few general or make sure that there are some general rules so that people are confident that the examiner that they're getting is an unbiased person, I think that that would be helpful. Not because I think the examiners aren't being impartial, but just because the appearance of impartiality is important.
Yeah, I agree completely. There's a need to maintain the integrity and the reputation of the RPM as being one that where both parties can have fair confidence in the impartiality and even-handedness of the examiner, even for a proceeding that's only supposed to be used where it's blatantly obvious when you look at the domain that there's infringement going on, but there still should be a presumption that the examiner isn't predisposed to be biased in favor of the complainant or the respondent. Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think that to a certain extent that does speak to the need to explore whether or not examiners are being drawn from one side or the other, one side more than the other. I mean, you know, you previously said, you know, these are professionals and they're doing their job and they represent people even-handedly, which is good. But, you know, regardless, if there's a skew in the people that are making these determinations, then it still goes to perception, even if 100% of them are completely fair. So I do think that it's important to keep that question about background and where they're being drawn from in. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for that, Michael. All right, let's move on to, we've got 9 minutes left. Maybe we can get through the next two sections and then wrap. Section 7, communication between parties and the examiner. No party or anyone acting on its behalf, that'd probably be counsel, may have unilateral communication with the examiner. All communications between a party and the examiner shall be, or the provider shall be made to the provider in the manner described in the provider's supplemental rules. So I think I would suggest we just wait and review the portion of each provider's supplemental rules regarding communications to make sure that they ensure that all communications are bilateral, all communications with the examiner are bilateral, and that nothing is being hid from one party or the other. Anyone else have any thoughts on Section 7? Section 8, general powers of the examiner. The examiner shall conduct the URS proceeding in a manner it considers appropriate in accordance with the URS procedure and these rules. In all cases, the examiner shall ensure that the parties are treated with equality to the extent feasible. I would gather that last term, the extent feasible, means would refer to default cases where you can't give equal weight to the response because there is no response. The examiner shall determine the admissibility, relevance, materiality, and weight of the evidence. And then the last part, if one or more domain names are registered with a privacy or proxy service, or the nominal registrant changes after the complaint is filed, and that would be an odd situation, would be a transfer of control after the domain is locked. It shall be the sole discretion of the examiner to determine if the respondents are sufficiently related and to dismiss the complaint with respect to any unrelated domain names. I guess we just want to ask a basic question on that odd possible scenario described in subpart D, whether any examiner, any provider knows of a situation where the nominal registrant has changed after the filing of the complaint. I would think that's a very rare circumstance if it's ever happened, but it wouldn't be difficult for the provider to answer, yes, that's happened once or twice, or No, to our knowledge, that's never happened. And then the final part, the examiner may rely on information submitted by the complainant and or the respondent in making its finding. So, you know, subpart A is kind of a qualitative judgment, as, you know, and that's a controversial area, but it just says the examiner shall conduct the proceeding in a manner in accordance with the rules and procedures, and treat both parties with equality to the extent feasible. And obviously, clearly, they have to determine the admissibility, relevance, material, and weight of the evidence. Other than if we should review cases qualitatively, and that's not what we're doing here in this sub-team, unless there's a decision to review some the cases for qualitative judgment, I don't know of any questions here other than asking the providers if they've ever had this odd situation of the nominal registrant changing after filing of the complaint, and how is their examiner handled that since they have sole discretion in those cases. Anybody else see any questions coming out of Section 8 here? All right, hearing no hands, I'm going to suggest at this point, it's 26 minutes past the hour, there's only 4 minutes left. The next section is fairly important for non-English-speaking complainants or respondents. I wouldn't want to try to rush through it in 3 minutes. So if anybody has any final thoughts, I would just say I think this has been a very beneficial exercise. We've gone through more than half of the URS rules. We've pulled out a fair number of suggested objective questions. So I would ask staff to, out of the notes, to before the next meeting, to circulate the questions or potential questions we pulled out of the review so far. I'd also ask staff in regard to, where was it? In regard to Section 6A, I would ask staff if they could go and look at the web pages of the three providers between now and the next meeting and see if they can find that the providers are maintaining and publicly making available their list of examiners and the examiner qualifications. That's a very simple objective question. It should be at their website. It's either there or it's not. If it's not there, we'd want to know why, but hopefully it is there. And I think if it is there, if the staff could capture screenshots so we can see at some point in our work who the examiners are and what their providers are, to see if their providers seem to be based relevant to deciding these type of cases, we can do that. Susan, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. It's a suggestion, and you may feel that this isn't helpful. But as we were going through it, and there have been a few cases where we've got to something and then you've gone, so, you know, we'll need to look at what the supplemental rules say. Do people on this call think it would be helpful if we had the kind of rules set out in a sort of table and then, you know, a column for the supplemental rules for the forum and a column for the supplemental rules for, you know, the other two providers? You know, sort of gridded out so that you've got the rules and then whatever the supplemental rules, if there are any on that particular rule from the three providers?
Yeah, actually, I think that's a very, very useful suggestion. Again, I think the supplemental rules are the last thing we want to review in this exercise, but if we could have them set side by side on a table, we could very easily see where, if anywhere, they differ in any material way, which would be a good thing to see. And you know, and then in reviewing them, we could decide, if somewhat a more subjective judgment, whether any portions of them either deviate in a material way from the rules and procedures that all providers are supposed to follow, or when any of them are trying to go beyond being administrative in nature and actually change the policy in some substantive way. So I think that's a real good suggestion, Susan. I don't think staff has to have that ready by next week. We're not going to need it by next week, but I think it's good to get on their radar screen.
Hello, Phil. This is Ariel from staff. So just on the clarifying the action item, I think I can create a table already for these URS rules with one column stating what the rules, and then second column suggested questions, and third column notes. Would that be useful at least for the sub-team to review what has been discussed so
well,
far?
Susan, was your suggestion to have the ICANN rules, the ICANN procedures, and then each provider supplemental rules that corresponded to them, or just the supplemental rules? And are we talking about three columns or five columns in your suggestion?
I think mine had been to have the rules and then the various provider supplemental rules that map to them. So that wasn't necessarily suggesting that it also captures the kind of notes and questions that we've identified, although if it wouldn't make a document that was too huge to handle, that I guess would be useful too.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's fine. Again, staff, I'd ask you to do that. We're not going to need that for next week, because next week we're going to continue. We're going to complete, hopefully, our review of the rules and move on to review, while the rules are fresh in our mind, move on to the procedures that were published by ICANN to implement the rules. I think we want to do that while the rules are still fresh in our mind, but at some point we won't need that side-by-side table. So thank you. We're at 1 minute past our scheduled time, but I think I see some comments that this was productive. I feel the same way. I think at the end of this process, we're going to have some very relevant, targeted, objective questions that will, once they're answered, will let us know whether the providers are carrying out the current or are operating in accord with the current rules and procedures. Then we can have a discussion of whether anyone thinks any of the rules and procedures should be changed based on experience with the URS. But our threshold question is, are they following the rules and procedures? And we're going to have a set of questions that will give us very clear answers on that. So thank you all, and we'll be on this again next week, is my understanding, which will be our final call before ICANN 61. And then I believe I'll be checking back with staff and the co-chairs, but I think these sub-teams will be doing some work at one of the RPM sessions. We've got four of them at ICANN. So we're looking to, I think, complete this exercise in March, and we'll wind up with a list of very objective questions that will give us clear answers. So thank you all, and have a great week, and we'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Great. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.
And thank you, everyone. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.